From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the president's now infamous July 25th phone call took center stage on Capitol Hill today, day three, week two of the public impeachment hearings. In that call, President Trump asked Ukraine's president to investigate Joe Biden. And this was just days after the president paused, promised military aid to the country. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, one of the two witnesses today and an official who listened in on the call, explained why he reported it to a National Security Council lawyer.
I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
NPR's congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is on Capitol Hill. She's been watching all this testimony. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
And so we're hearing from Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and Jennifer Williams, who's a foreign service aide who had been assigned to Vice President Pence and in that role was also listening in on the call. Anything that you heard today we didn't know before today?
Yes, taking quite a bit away from today's testimony. These witnesses are very compelling, the way they're delivering this testimony on camera. We've read their transcripts, but they've brought their claims of what they heard on that July 25th call firsthand. They're bringing it to life. And it's taking us that much closer to the sequence of events leading up to that phone call, the phone call itself, and the events that followed. And they both said they found concern with it. And Vindman in particular, he reported his concerns to the top lawyer of the National Security Council that it was improper for the president to ask a foreign country to investigate a U.S. citizen, in this case, the Bidens. And Williams recounted a visit to the new Ukrainian leader that was planned with the vice president, but was scratched within weeks and ahead of this July 25th call.
Right. And we also heard a little bit more about the other part of the rough transcript that was released of that call. In the beginning, not a lot of people understood what it meant, but it was the president asking the president of Ukraine, President Trump asking the president of Ukraine, about a conspiracy theory long debunked about the 2016 election. And that debunked theory, the thought that somebody in Ukraine has a server that apparently the Democratic National Committee says they still have, the Democratic counsel Daniel Goldman asked Lieutenant Colonel Vindman about the reason that President Trump brought up that debunked conspiracy theory in this phone call. Let's listen.
Now, at the time of this July 25th call, Colonel Vindman, were you aware of a theory that Ukraine had intervened or interfered in the 2016 U.S. election?
I was.
Are you aware of any credible evidence to support this theory?
I am not.
Are you also aware that Vladimir Putin had promoted this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election?
I am well aware of that fact.
And then, Claudia, he went on to say, Vindman went on to say that all U.S. intelligence agreed that Russia was the body that interfered in the U.S. election. But it seems as if today, more than on some of the other days, the Republicans' goal has been to talk about either, you know, interference in the election or the Bidens. There seems to be much more emphasis on that.
Yes, it's pretty interesting. They're narrowing their focus. Previous arguments have been, we're not talking to witnesses who heard this call firsthand. Well, here we are. We're hearing them firsthand. So they're moving on to a stronger focus on Russia and its role and kind of narrowing in on questions such as Devin Nunes, for example, was asking both witnesses, Williams and Vindman, if either of them mentioned in their private testimony or in today's public testimony that bribery was involved in the exchange between President Trump and this Ukrainian leader, and both said no. And so that is one area of focus. Nunes, earlier in his opening statement, he blamed the media for spinning the Democratic narrative, and he revisited the, quote, Russia hoax and some of these debunked theories, as you mentioned. They're coming up again in today's discussion.
And Jennifer Williams, people have been referring to her as an assistant to Vice President Pence or an aide. She is not. She's a foreign service, a career foreign service person who's been assigned to his office, which is usual, and has described Condoleezza Rice today as a personal hero. What have we gleaned from her in the few seconds we have?
Well, Williams has definitely made clear that in her role, even though she was assigned to the vice president, she is a State Department employee, but in her role, she had concern about this phone call, this July 25th call between President Trump and the leader of Ukraine. Yeah. So she's made that pretty clear today.
NPR's congressional reporter, Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there are a number of officials who are not testifying in hearings this week or possibly ever, even though they are central to the events surrounding President Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukraine's president. The Washington Post's Carol Linick has been following these missing officials. Carol, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. He's also the director of the Office of Management and Budget. And over the weekend, House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff, a Democrat, again called on him to testify. Mulvaney has refused. Can you remind us of why he's so important in all of this?
Mick Mulvaney is really critical in this drama unfolding both in the testimony before Congress last week and again this week, because he is the person pulling the purse strings that affect Ukraine. He is the person at the president's direction who blocks the military aid that Congress has authorized from getting to the Ukraine government. Mm. And that aid is used almost as a bargaining chip, according to some of the witnesses. The president is not going to release the aid, some state diplomats tell Ukrainian officials, until you agree to this investigation that he wants of a Democratic rival.
Okay, and to be clear, Mulvaney has refused to testify, correct?
Yes, Mulvaney has now told the House that he is going to abide by the White House's instructions and not cooperate in the investigation.
Okay. Another person who comes up in this is former National Security Advisor John Bolton. And Bolton has been quoted as describing the pressure campaign on Ukraine as a, quote, drug deal. What is the status with Democrats' attempts to hear from him?
It's complicated by the fact that John Bolton chose a path that other very senior advisors to the White House so far have not chosen. Remember that the White House counsel, the lawyer for the White House, has instructed everyone in the administration not to cooperate in this investigation. They're on very flimsy legal ground in making that argument to, say, a state diplomat or a public servant, a career official in one of the agencies. They're on stronger legal footing when they ask for senior advisors in the White House not to cooperate with the probe because it could divulge allegedly some sort of privileged communications with the president. John Bolton chose a different path than other White House officials of this stature by not agreeing to do what the White House said, but by saying he needs a court's decision on whether or not he should comply with the House subpoena.
Okay, so he's waiting to see the results of a lawsuit over whether White House officials have to comply with the congressional subpoena. What is the state of that lawsuit?
That lawsuit is, in a sense, pending. The presiding judge, a D.C. federal judge named Richard Leon, is supposed to hear arguments in the second week of December.
Why can't it be fast-tracked? I mean, we're right in the middle of these inquiry hearings.
Well, courts don't work on a political schedule, and a trial judge, a trial judge understandably wants to hear the evidence and the arguments. And after that, you know, an appellate court is probably going to review whatever Dick Leon says. And then this could go all the way to the Supremes. It usually takes some months for this to work its way up to that level.
Okay. Who else do you think would be important to hear from?
I think it's going to be very important to hear from the White House lawyers who received the complaints about the president's actions, both in the July 25th call, and also these White House lawyers received complaints earlier in July, July 10th, when they heard Ambassador Sondland saying to Ukrainian officials, look, you're not going to get the aid, you're not going to get a meeting until you do what the president wants with these investigations. Those White House lawyers, what did they do with those complaints? Did they suss out the legality of what the president had asked with the Department of Justice?
In all of this, Democrats have said that the fact that the White House isn't allowing these officials to testify about all of this could be evidence of obstruction. What do you make of the fact that so many people who are so central to what happened are not testifying?
I think that the only thing we can make of it at this point is that they believe they've got a legal cover or a legal argument to stand on. However, I would just stress that so many witnesses have now come forward who worked for these individuals that aren't testifying, who received emails and text messages from these individuals, and they are cooperating. For example, we should be listening to what Alex Vindman is saying about what he learned from John Bolton, what John Bolton told him, and John Bolton's very serious concern that this was a drug deal and that whatever was going on was very dangerous for the White House.
Carol Linick is investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We're following today's public impeachment hearings on Capitol Hill. Two top national security aides who listened to President Trump's July 25th phone call with the president of Ukraine have been testifying that they thought it was wrong that President Trump asked the Ukrainian leader about political investigations into Joe Biden and the 2016 elections as the president withheld military aid to that country. The witnesses, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, an Army officer at the National Security Council, and Jennifer Williams, a former Foreign Service officer detailed to the staff of Vice President Mike Pence's office. Here's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in his opening statement.
It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent. I was also clear that if Ukraine pursued an investigation, into the 2016 elections, the Bidens and Burisma, it would be interpreted as a partisan play. This would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing bipartisan support, undermining U.S. national security, and advancing Russia's strategic objectives in the region.
And here's Jennifer Williams in hers.
I found the July 25th phone call unusual because, in contrast to other presidential calls I had observed, it involved discussion of what appeared to be a domestic political matter. After the July 25th call, I provided an update in the Vice President's daily briefing book indicating that President Trump had a call that day with President Zelensky. A hard copy of the memorandum transcribing the call was also included in the book. I do not know whether the Vice President reviewed my update or the transcript. I did not discuss the July 25th call with the Vice President or any of my colleagues in the Office of the Vice President or the NSC.
Let's get context, as we always do, from Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And last week's testimony, people who heard about the phone call, witnesses today actually heard it. Now, 70% of Americans, according to the new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, agree with those two witnesses. 70% of Americans believe that the president asking a foreign leader to investigate a political rival is not acceptable. But Americans are divided, 50-43%, on whether there should be an impeachment. Can you think of a time when a clear majority of Americans saw something so clearly wrong but not actionable?
Well, no, although in Watergate there was clearly a sense in the public of wrongdoing, but only about 40-43% of the public as late as April of 1974 believed that impeachment was the solution. And there was a little bit with Iran-Contra in 1986 and 87. I don't know what the polls were, but there was a lot of clearly public outrage about the administration basically running a secret policy, but impeachment wasn't on the table. So we can have a disconnect like this. This is a partisan disconnect. I think that's the added element.
Well, and in this case, we have an election coming up, and maybe a lot of Americans are feeling, well, why not settle it, you know, in the voting booth? We can do more polling and find out about that. But as you watched, what jumped out at you today?
Well, it was pretty remarkable just to watch the witnesses. Vindman is a very compelling figure. He's not the person that many Republicans are making him out to be. He's clearly what we saw last week, a public servant through the military who felt the need to speak their mind and saw something wrong. What's also remarkable is the Republicans are just not talking really about the substance. They aren't challenging the basic story. They're just saying, is it as bad as everyone says it is? And back to the opening today, it was all about the media rather than the actual evidence being gathered. So it's almost as if they've thrown their hands up and they're going to say Biden every time they can say it. And then they're going to ask, does this really warrant impeachment?
Well, I want to ask you about that. Let's put a pause button for a second on today. But we were just discussing this, that the fact that the questioning from the Republican side hasn't really been as much about the phone call. There have been questions there, and we will get to that. But more about Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Burisma and Hunter Biden being on the board of Burisma. Do you think, Julian, that the Democrats are taking this up as well as they can? I mention it because I go back to some reporting that we have from like 2015. James Risen in 2015 wrote about then Vice President Joe Biden going to Ukraine on his mission that he'd been, you know, doggedly working at, fighting corruption in Ukraine. Here's the lead sentence. When Vice President Joe Biden traveled to Kiev on Sunday for a series of meetings with the country's leaders, one of the issues on his agenda was to encourage a more aggressive fight against Ukraine's rampant corruption. But the credibility of the vice president's anti-corruption message may have been undermined by the association of his son Hunter with one of Ukraine's largest natural gas companies, Burisma Holdings. This is in 2015. This was not a secret. This was back on page 25 of the New York Times. Nobody really cared that much about it. But the thrust of the article, and James Risen has talked to us more recently about this, was everybody knew Joe Biden was ferociously trying to fight corruption, and there was a thinking that his son being on this board might be bad optics. What happened to kind of distort that to now being that Joe Biden was protecting his son?
Well, everything changed in 2016. The story was picked up, I believe, first in the New York Times, and the administration saw a vulnerability in one of the top candidates that they faced. And so they turned this knowledge of a son who, you know, capitalized on his father's name into a story about the alleged corruption of a vice president. And what the president has learned and what many Republicans have learned, even if it's a discredited story, it doesn't mean that it's not a powerful political story in our day and age because of the conservative media. And that's why they have this national airtime right now, and they're trying to get the story, as you describe it, right back on the air.
Well, but
The problem they're facing is just the how powerful the testimony is, not about Biden, but about what the president and his team did.
But our Democrats, are they right in your view to kind of skirt it, which they have been today? For instance, they would ask a couple of times of the witnesses, had you ever heard anything or were you aware of Joe Biden doing anything wrong? And they said no. Should they go more straight on the nose with it and say things like reporting from the time showed that he was actually pursuing American policy? Should they, or would that be them getting distracted?
That's them getting baited by the Republicans. I think what's clear is Congressman Schiff is trying to keep the Democratic questions, the questions of the attorney, Dan Goldman, focused on the president, and they don't want to start, you know, a 20-minute debate about Joe Biden. And I don't know if it's the most effective. That's for a strategist to answer, but I think there's something to it. I think the evidence of what we've seen in the last 2 weeks is this is damaging the president. It's not damaging the Democrats or Joe Biden, so maybe they're onto something.
Let's listen to another clip from today's hearings. This is the Democratic counsel questioning Vindman and Williams.
President Trump demanded a favor of President Zelensky to conduct investigations that both of you acknowledge were for President Trump's political interest, not the national interest, and in return for his promise of a much-desired White House meeting for President Zelensky. Colonel Vindman, is that an accurate summary of the excerpts that we just looked at?
Yes.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
So that's pretty damning there. But, Julian, we have this new polling from NPR, PBS NewsHour, Marist. And one of the numbers that jumps out is that 65% say they can't imagine any information or circumstance during the impeachment inquiry where they might change their minds.
Well, that is very telling, especially given what we're learning. Just from a historian's perspective, this is not normal foreign policy, and I am someone who believes politics is often part of foreign policy. This is a whole other level of misbehavior and abuse of power. But maybe those polls are registering something about our political world right now, where there's just little movement on anything. And that gives an advantage to any person caught up in the swirl of a scandal of this size.
Yeah. A couple moments today where the Republicans went a little more directly at these two witnesses, asking Williams if she told anybody else about this call. She was adamant she didn't. And asking Vindman about a time when Ukrainians came to ask him to take a high office there. Now, this is, again, a new Ukraine that's broken away and is trying to fend off Russia. There seemed to be sort of more than a whiff of an implication that about where his questions about where his loyalties lie. How did that moment go for you?
That was really unbelievable. It wasn't a whiff, it was a stench.
Okay.
That's what the Republicans were doing. They were trying to question his loyalty, his character, because they understand the image of him, his background, really adds weight to what he's saying and why he was so worried about what he saw. I don't think it's going to work, other than in loyal Republican circles. I think he responded very strongly and made it clear what he's done his whole career. And he's literally, served through his own body. I don't think that's going to work for Republicans. It's not good when politicians go after decorated military officials like that.
Yeah, he has given blood, actually, for this country. And we should say, you say his background, his mother died. His father brought he and his brother as toddlers to the U.S. As Vindman said, he was kind of funny about it. He said, look, I'm an American through and through. I would not want that job. But also, why are they coming after me? I'm not even, qualified for that job. And he seemed to laugh it off. But in the beginning, there was a very powerful moment when he actually spoke to his dad in his opening statement and said, you did the right thing bringing us to the U.S. I can tell the truth here.
Well, that was powerful, not just for this particular investigation and set of hearings, but in some ways it was a moment about the Trump presidency. Here's someone literally speaking truth to power, not a Democrat, someone from the military, and the country watched him end on that statement to his father.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Thanks as always, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
I know you have the best intentions. You want to keep up with the impeachment hearings, but maybe you have a job. There will be hours of testimony from witnesses in the impeachment inquiry this week, and the NPR Politics podcast will be there every afternoon to keep you up to date on all the key moments. Listen daily.
Let's turn now to the Middle East, where protests in Iran over high gas prices are now in their fifth day. Amnesty International has reported more than 100 deaths in these protests. Some reports indicate higher numbers. That's not the only problem, though. Iran is also facing major backlash in Iraq over revelations about its influence there. And for more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hey, how are you?
So obviously, these protests have been violent. Remind us why the Iranians are protesting.
Well, so it's largely about economics, right? Iranians are to some degree, have been frustrated by their government for many, many years. In fact, there was if you recall, the Green Revolution in 2009. But there are two things that go on in Iran. One is there's a detente, really, between the government and people who sort of say, look, not everybody likes their government in Iran, but they know what the rules are and they live by it. The problem is the Iranian economy, prior to the nuclear deal and now since the U.S. has pulled out of the nuclear deal, has suffered. Inflation is rampant. It's over 40%. And part of the problem is the Iranian government subsidizes gasoline. They have now reduced that subsidy because they're broke. And this is what people are protesting. So there's an undercurrent about not loving how the government is running. And then there's the basic economics, very high inflation. And the last straw was the gas subsidies.
Let's talk more about that undercurrent involving the government. These protests have been really described as fairly spontaneous, but also broad based, directly targeting the entire regime. How common is it to see Iranians defy the government like this?
It's not common. We saw it in 2009. We saw it again in 2017. That was also pegged to gasoline prices. It's very, very hard in Iran to protest the government. The security services are very strong. Justice is very swift and stern. And it is very hard. There's no organized opposition movement, because even to run for office as an opposition leader, you have to be cleared by the government. You have to be religious enough and not a dissident and all those kinds of things. So there's a lot of feeling of dissidents in Iran, but they can't organize. So there is a sort of a spontaneity to this sort of thing. In fact, what the government did after these protests started is they cut off somewhere close to 90% of the internet in the country throttled it back, because they know that's how it spreads. The Green Revolution in 2009 was kind of entirely spread on Twitter. You remember that was that young woman who was shot and her picture was shown all over. So it's the only way a protest can occur in Iran, through relative spontaneity. But the frustration, and I recall being there before the Iran deal was signed, people certainly wouldn't openly speak to an American journalist about their frustrations with their own government. But when you spoke about the economy, they were remarkably frustrated. And in the end, so many protests around the world are about something else, but the trigger tends to be when people can't afford to get their basic goods.
There are also all of these protests that are happening in Iraq. There are more than 320 people have been killed there. There's so much happening here. Very quickly, 30 seconds that I have with you. What do you think we could be witnessing, a turning point in Iran at this point?
Yeah, well, so Iraq is also, people are frustrated by corruption and the lack of a government to be able to do anything. But they're also protesting the fact that Iran has undue influence in Iraq. It's the same thing as Iran. It's a young people's protest against old governments with too much power. So Iran involved in both of these.
Thank you so much, Ali. No problem. Yes, thank you so much, Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery is one of the most visited sites in the nation. People come to witness the Honor Guard patrols who watch over the tomb 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's also the place where American leaders mark each Veterans and Memorial Day. Here's President Ronald Reagan on Memorial Day in 1984.
When he spoke at a ceremony at Gettysburg in 1863, President Lincoln reminded us that through their deeds, the dead had spoken more eloquently for themselves than any of the living ever could, and that we're living could only honor them by rededicating ourselves to the cause for which they so willingly gave a last full measure of devotion.
The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was dedicated on November 11th, 1921, 3 years to the day after the end of World War I. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock went to Arlington in 2018 and brought back this story about the origins of the Unknown Soldier, and we are rebroadcasting his story today.
After the carnage of World War I, nations that had lost millions of service members were looking for a way to honor those dead. They found a simple concept with powerful symbolism: the remains of one unidentified soldier buried with honor to recognize the service and sacrifice of the many. An unidentified French soldier was buried under the Arc de Triomphe. Britain interred its unknown in Westminster Abbey.
And then here in the United States, a woman editor of a very famous publication at the time, The Delineator, Marie Maloney, decided to send a letter to the brass, that something needs to be done to honor our men.
Patrick O'Donnell is author of The Unknowns, The Untold Story of America's Unknown Soldier and World War I's Most Decorated Heroes Who Brought Him Home. Soon after the war ended, New York Congressman and combat veteran Hamilton Fish introduced legislation that called for the return of an unknown American who had been buried in France to be reburied in the United States. Again, author Patrick O'Donnell.
It was in Chalon, France, that four bodies, unknown bodies from four of the cemeteries that were the major fighting had taken place in the American Expeditionary Force, were selected. Unknowns were selected. They were very carefully checked to make sure that there was nothing in there that could identify who these men were. And the burial tickets were actually burned after the bodies were selected. And the four bodies were were selected and then brought to Chalons, France, and put in the city hall there.
A sergeant from Chicago, Edward Younger, was given the honor of selecting from the four unknowns. Only one would be coming home.
And he's sort of the quintessential doughboy. This is an individual that fought in many of the major battles right outside of Belle Wood at Vaux, for instance, through the war at a place called Blancmont, which was kind of like, think of the guns of Navarone. It's this incredibly fortified position, which for years the French could never take. And the 2nd Division, which Edward Younger and the Marines in the 4th Brigade were part of, were able to seize Blancmont in an epic struggle. But Edward Younger finds himself there that night, and he's given the honor to select the unknown soldier. And they hand him a bouquet of flowers that morning, a bouquet of roses, and said, please choose the individual. And he walked into the room where the sun was starting to come in and just felt a presence that one of the men in one of the caskets was somebody that had fallen beside him. And he laid the flowers down on the casket, and that is the unknown soldier that's buried here.
Once selected, the unknown soldier started his final journey.
They bring him back to the United States on board the USS Olympia, which is, you know, this storied warship that Admiral Dewey had. The Olympia brings it back. It comes into the Washington Navy Yard, and the body bearers, the 8 men that are in this book, bring back the remains. It first goes to the Rotunda, Capitol Rotunda, where he lies. There's, you know, thousands of Americans that see him. And then the procession comes down from Washington to here in Arlington. And, you know, initially Pershing was supposed to be on horseback, but he just wanted to be a regular mourner and walked behind the caisson with the unknown.
Pershing was General John Blackjack Pershing. He was commander of American forces. The 8 body bearers were among the most decorated Americans who fought in World War I, including 2 Medal of Honor recipients. These men carried the casket to the tomb site in Arlington National Cemetery and stood with thousands of other mourners for the burial service.
This was an incredibly important event in 1921, on November 11th. This was a chance of healing. Everyone was in, you know, many of the leading organizations, the NAACP, many folks were invited to this ceremony. And one of the things that I found really interesting is it was the last person, as the unknown was being placed in the tomb, was Chief Plenicluse, who was a Crow war chief, was given the honor of placing his warhammer on top of the tomb, and he says several words where, you know, even says later on that education is your greatest weapon. But it's part of the healing process of, you know, for many, many years we fought Native Americans, but, you know, this is a chance for them to come together. And one of the body bearers, Corporal Saunders, was also a Native American, Comanche, and one of the most decorated Native Americans in the AEF.
Patrick O'Donnell there talking about Thomas Saunders, who was born in Medicine Bow, Wyoming.
Saunders is extraordinary in the sense that he is in charge of, he has to breach the wire. He has to, with wire cutters, he has to go out and breach the wire so that the infantry can go through. Otherwise, they would just be destroyed by the machine guns. And, you know, single-handedly goes out this sort of forlorn hope to a suicide mission. And breaches the wire at a place called San Mihel where the Americans have an offensive. And he's deep behind the lines, German lines. And you know, quite extraordinary, captures single-handedly over 60 German soldiers.
Among the other body bearers on that day in November 1921 was Army Sergeant Samuel Woodfill from Indiana. He was a Medal of Honor recipient, a man General Pershing described as one of the greatest American soldiers of the war. There was also a sailor, James Delaney of Boston. He spent 15 months in a German prisoner of war camp. And Ernest Jansen, a Marine who earned the Medal of Honor for his actions at Belleau Wood. On Armistice Day 1921, these body bearers stood at attention beside the casket of the unknown soldier before it was lowered into its final resting place.
So all these years later, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is just one of the most hallowed places in the United States. It's, you know, I don't, millions of people probably visit this area every year. What does the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier mean to the U.S. in terms of military history and just history in general? What does it mean to, what does this place mean?
This is hallowed ground. It's sacred ground. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier represents all who served and who've have fallen for the United States.
The white marble Tomb of the Unknown Soldier stands atop a hill in Arlington National Cemetery that overlooks Washington. On the east panel are Greek figures representing peace, victory, and valor. There are also six wreaths, three on each side. Those represent the six major military campaigns of World War I. On the back of the tomb, the side you see if you're visiting Arlington, are these words. Here rests, in honored glory, an American soldier known but to God. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlar.
Some news to note as we keep track of the impeachment hearings. After a long dry spell, Los Angeles may get its first taste of rain this season, starting later today. But further north, fire weather is in the forecast as residents prepare for another round of potential blackouts. The state's largest utility, PG&E, warns hundreds of thousands of customers in 22 counties in Northern California that their power could be shut off as soon as tomorrow during high winds to try to prevent those outdated lines and towers from sparking wildfires. Just yesterday, PG&E's CEO Bill Johnson testified in a hearing with lawmakers that the company was not as well prepared as they thought for the impacts of last month's widespread shutoffs that impacted millions of people. Last week, the state's Public Utilities Commission opened a formal investigation into those shutoffs. Well, meanwhile, Californians are also reeling from recent mass shootings. In just 4 days, 10 people were killed in three different incidents of gun violence, including those two teenagers shot to death at a high school in Santa Clarita, just north of L.A., by a 16-year-old fellow student. How to keep students safe from school shootings? Well, there's a great debate about that. But from member station KUNC, Lee Patterson went to an active shooter training at a school in northern Colorado, which focused on three chilling actions: evacuate, barricade, and fight.
Standing on blue gym mats under bright fluorescent lights, a trainer and a student lean in, heads close.
So nice and low, athletic, like, you know, get your body weight into it. Slap, bear hug, straight down.
The student nods. Others watch from the bleachers and sitting on the gym floor.
Okay, ready? Here we go.
Then, a man wearing knee and chest pads steps onto the mat. He's holding a fake orange gun. The student grabs him, takes him down. A bunch of other boys pile on top as the trainers, former SWAT team members and other law enforcement officers, give instructions. These high school students really do seem to be having fun, but they're prepping for a nightmare scenario, that there's an active shooter in the building. This particular exercise represents the fight part of evacuate, barricade, fight, the three steps that a company called TAC-1 is teaching at Pinnacle Charter School in North Denver at its first ever active shooter training for students.
My name is Chad Miller. I'm Chief Executive Officer at Pinnacle Charter School.
Between training sessions, Miller and I talk in a classroom sitting on small kid chairs. He says that his thinking on school safety has evolved over the years for three main reasons. First, the level of everyday community violence, stuff like guns, drugs, gangs. Then, 2 years ago, there was a mass shooting at a Walmart nearby. Three people died. And finally,
after the STEM shooting, that really changed things. That changed the game.
A school shooting, multiple injuries, this time outside Denver. And what
two students have been charged with opening fire at the STEM school in May, injuring eight and killing one. Kendrick Castillo, a student who tried to take down the shooter.
And there's some heroes in that situation. How many lives did they save by doing that?
Just days before the STEM shooting, a student at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, was also killed while trying to stop a gunman. So I asked Miller, considering that those young men died rushing a shooter, why does he still support fight as a tactic?
Hopefully the kids have options. Hopefully the kids can run away. Hopefully they can hide. Hopefully they can barricade. If they're in close proximity and they have no other options, here's what you're probably going to have to do, and here's how to do that.
TAC 1 has taught the evacuate, barricade, fight classes in four other schools in Wyoming and Arizona. None of those students have had to use the skills they learned in an active shooter situation. And broadly, there's just not much data on how well these tactics actually work.
Is fighting the best thing to do?
In the gym, one of the trainers runs through the three options.
I want you to have choices. There's no one best thing to do.
After that fight training, I talked with two seniors, Brianna.
My name is Brianna Centeno.
And Giovanni.
Giovanni J. Medina Rico.
They both said they felt empowered with their new skills. Compared to other types of gun violence, mass shootings are rare. But for these two, the possibility of having to fight is absolutely real.
If it was, you know, life or death and I'm the leader, it's definitely something that I think I would have to do morally. Like, I feel like since we are the oldest in the school, I should look out for those that are younger than me.
In talking about the young man who died tackling the shooter at the STEM school,
it just makes me feel emotional knowing about that. It's kind of hard to say, but like, I would lay down my life if I had to protect my classmates. And it just makes me emotional knowing that someone had to take their life just to protect everybody else.
After we talked, Brianna and Giovanni ate their lunches and then finished up their day of training. Now, it's back to regular high school stuff. Football, student council, and graduation at the end of the year. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Patterson.
And Lee's story comes to us from Guns and America, a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. The impeachment hearings continue. U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland is due to appear. We'll talk with our political strategist about how things are going.
And then the next Democratic debate. 10 candidates will be on stage. We'll have a preview next time, Here and Now.